The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana, bringing Montanans together to learn and reflect for 40 years, and by listeners like you.
You spent part of your childhood living in northern Cheyenne country in Montana. How did those years influence your writing and your career choices?
Mostly I was running around as a junior high brat at the first part. So the influence was more like basketball and friendship and a lot of great brotherhood and enjoyment of life together with Leif Haugen and Booger Red Bement, if you can imagine, Cleveland Bement, and Blake Walksnice and Russell Tall White Man. And then as I grew older, I think what really influenced me was the idea of circular cultures versus individual cultures and the gift culture rather than the capitalistic economy. And what I had experienced there were deep gifts of love and brotherhood that have stayed with me as a writer, as a poet, and as a novelist.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with award-winning author Shan Ray about his debut novel, American Copper. Before this novel, you published four books. Two were nonfiction, and then you published an award-winning collection of short stories and an award-winning collection of poetry. So why a novel?
I think I've always loved all the expressions of writing and reading, nonfiction, poetry, short stories, novels. Poetry's first love, maybe because of a love for landscape and the world, maybe what we might call the world's body as well as the human body. And that has attracted me deeply to landscape poets as well as poets that cover the human body. And I think of people like Catherine Barnett and Game of Boxes and also C.D. Wright, and especially her book Deep Step Come Shining. And then people like M.L. Smoker here in the state and James Welch and some of his early poetry. So poetry being a first love naturally attracted me out from there towards short stories and novels. Short stories, I think I'm inspired by how it's like American jazz, and it is a foundational American movement, the short story. And I've always felt that our region should and can be one of the most important as far as short story writing, and I think it actually has become that over the years. So that developed the attraction to the short story. And then novels are what I would call the thing that people love most as far as reading. And so I've always wanted to write novels as well, but felt that I should wait so that it could come out more closely to what I envisioned it might come out to. So I was always trying novels, but knowing that they weren't really working, there four, I think five failed novels before this one. And this one, I could tell a difference and probably had a lot to do with the poetry that I was writing already and the short stories I was writing.
I see so much of your poetry and your short stories in this novel, which is part of what made it really beautiful. I mean, your descriptions of the land and the people are poetry.
Thank you.
There are three main characters in American Copper: Evelyn, Zion, and William. And before we talk about Zion and William, let's just hear a short passage that takes place during Evelyn's childhood. It's 1907, and she's 5 years old.
Slender as a sapling, she stood that night on a black hickory table in the great room. Her father was a man hard as granite with other men, a man of fist, commerce, and copper. Joseph, he called himself. Others called him the Baron. Joseph Lowry had more money than the Montana State Treasury. Born in America, but checked by blood, he had changed his surname, Vavrick, to the English equivalent, Lowry, and made men suffer. He was unfriendly with Washington, but respected. His men dug copper from the ground. He sent it by train to the centers of industry. I move this country, he thought. He smiled for her brother too, but Tomas was in town with the tutor Joseph retained to prepare him for Harvard, where he would make his father proud. Tonight the dignitaries of Montana gathered with their wives in the great room wide-eyed. The men endured with slick hair, part lines clean and straight, faces shaven, black or brown full beaver felt hats in hand, derbies and straights, tapers and cowboy hats. The women wore gloves and fine dresses, beads like gemstones set in silk at shoulder or hip. People milled beneath the electric burn of a bohemian crystal chandelier shipped from Prague, a many-armed work of art, high, wide, and full of light, the room lit to every corner. Alder, pine, and maple at floor and ceiling, great ponderosa logs stripped of their bark for walls. The tart smell of fresh wood. Throughout, deer and antelope antlers were set in European mounts, clean skull with darkened horns, the death's heads, like silent touchstones of days he'd ridden out at dawn, returning with the animal lane across the rump of his horse. A comfort to him, a sense of solace. He watched the women, their flowing curls and well-shaped gowns, a reminder of the wife he'd lost. His face started to crack, but he steeled himself before he called to his daughter in a loud voice, "Evelyn, child of my heart." She smiled, blushed. Too meek, he thought. He went to her at the table and stood before her, holding her hand. He beamed at the people, and they applauded even before she began. If only his father were here, he thought, a man he imagined dead of poverty or anguish. They hadn't spoken since St. Louis. He'd hold his father's head in his low convalescent bed, mine worker, railroad hand, track layer, fighter crushed by rock. In Joseph's waking dream, the old man rose and stood tall, smiling like Joseph had never seen. The governor and his lieutenants, the head of the railway and his henchmen, they were all here now in the public dining room with their women to listen to Joseph's daughter, because Joseph wanted them to be here, and because they knew he was richer and more powerful than the lot of them. Dark wine and tall glasses, prime cuts of Montana beefsteak, tumblers of cognac, thick cigars, the air perfumed by feminine skin, they dined like royalty as they held their women. The men guffawed and bragged as they tried to pump themselves up in the face of their host's wealth, his mountain castle so unlike the paper shacks and hillside dugouts he'd known as a boy. Tonight, he thought, his princess was like a small queen. With her crushed velvet dress and white lace collar, white silk gloves, and her mother's pearl necklace, the gift of oysters of the Orient tripled around her delicate neck. His face wanted to break again. His wife should be here. He set his voice like a rail before him. "I present to you the Queen of Montana." He flourished his hand as everyone applauded, hooted, hollered. Evelyn's face flushed. Joseph made eye contact, nodded, the aftertaste of buttered steak in his mouth. She lifted her eyes, then proceeded to recite without error 10 Shakespearean sonnets, each made with 14 knotted lines filled with tongue twists and turns, 3 quatrains and a couplet, 140 lines in all. Joseph was seen mouthing the words. He thought of his father's thick accent. The king's English was the English his children knew, Shakespeare the pinnacle. When she finished, the people roared their approval. Joseph lifted Evelyn from the table and set her on the hardwood floor. She looked at the bodies flowing around her. She turned to her father and tucked herself to his pant legs. But he bellowed with laughter. She pinched his leg before she ran wildly from the room, his voice booming behind her. "Well done, Evelyn, well done." And quieter. "Come back, child." But she stayed away.
Evelyn grows up privileged, almost beyond comprehension. Her father, as you wrote, had more money than the Montana State Treasury. But he always wanted more. What fueled his obsession?
I've always been fascinated by what fuels all of our obsessions, and some of those my wife and I were talking about on the drive from Spokane to Montana, that some hungers are maybe the counterpart or the distinct healing component to the actual addictive hungers that we have. And so, for example, I think we have a deep desire for legitimate, authentic, transparent love between us and other people. However, when we look back at Lowry's family, his father was very tough to work with, and that means his mother was very tough to work with too in her way. And so when we look at him, he was then faced, kind of like Thomas Jefferson, if you know his story, with the death of his first love, the death of his wife, who might have, you know, the feminine essence of his wife might have brought him to more compassionate hungers, but instead he was sort of swallowed up by his emptiness, and in the end he couldn't get himself back from it. And we see that throughout the novel, and we see Evelyn, who we might call the moral center of the work, moving in her different ways with her own shadows and her own light, but against basically the will of that emptiness. In any case, I think for people like most Americans who tend to have greater privilege than 95% of the world, with greater privilege or with a dominant culture perspective, it becomes very difficult to maintain humility and a stance of giving away one's wealth to the betterment of others.
The other two main characters, Zion and William, come from different parts of Montana. William is from the Northern Cheyenne Reservation in southeast Montana, and Zion is from the Highline. So tell us who they are and what brings them out so that they eventually get into contact with Evelyn.
I've lived in all these areas and traveled in them a lot through basketball and sometimes through fishing or hunting. And so the Cheyenne Reservation was a natural outpouring through the brotherhood I mentioned, especially with Leif Haugen. And so William Blackettle is a lot like Leif. He has a vibrant, vital way of viewing people. And so his engagement with the world is basically fearless, which sometimes can be very difficult because that fearlessness will, you know, draw him into encounters that often turn drastically violent. And other times it draws him into encounters that have the capacity to heal us and make us whole, which my friend Leif was great at that and still is great at that. He's a leader of the housing authority on the Cheyenne Reservation, Northern Cheyenne Reservation now, and just a beautiful person, beautiful leader, and one that uplifts the Northern Cheyenne young at a constant pace through his coaching and just through who he is in the community. And so that whole experience of Leif and his family and other friends of mine on the Cheyenne Reservation and their families and how they loved my family so easily and fluidly, despite the national genocidal history, is what's represented in the Peace Chief Black Kettle from before the 1864 massacre of the Cheyennes conducted by the U.S. military on up to today. And so William Black Kettle came from that essence, which I think is a powerful, beautiful, warrior-like, and also a deep embrace of the feminine, transcendent type of ethos. And Zion came from hardscrabble, highline. My dad grew up in Circle. My mom grew up in Cohagen, which is not the highline, but it's just out there on the high plains. And I just think of a lot of the friends I've had over the years that are just big, strong, willing to die for you type men that often don't have a pathway into a sense of deep love for the women in their lives and for the ability to generate tenderness at the same rate as, or at an overcoming rate or a transcendent rate versus generating violence. And so, Zion is a tragic character because he wants to love deeply, but his fear doesn't allow him to come into the intimacy, and his history shades him and often entraps him from being able to come into a more realized love that he could experience. I think he makes his stand for love in the end, but it's a tragic stand.
Well, he's attracted to Evelyn, but he can't act on his feelings. And I got the idea that might be partly because he just wasn't well socialized.
And I think that was mainly his family. I mean, there's plenty of well socialized Highliners. Hello, Highliners. But this one, the family was just so desperate, and so full of loneliness and actual hate. Like the father had a very severe vein of hate. And the mother was always trying to compensate, I think. And so I agree with you that he never really came out into a legitimate socialization and was trying throughout his life. But I think also some type of honoring of his mother maybe was speaking to him about, how it's very hard for all of us to escape the shadows of our generations. I think something was speaking to him that didn't allow him to open,
One of the poems in your collection, which is titled Balefire, must have been written about Zion. At least that's what I thought. It's called The Violence Elegies. Do you mind reading that for us?
I'd love to. And I'm glad you noticed that. That actually came from one of my professors for poetry. His name's Chris Howell, and he has many beautiful books. But his book, Light's Ladder, is a deep influence on my life. And in class with him, he had mentioned entire passages of Cormac McCarthy and of Marilynne Robinson can stand alone as poems or entire chapters, I think is how he said it. And that got me thinking, 10 years ago, these things should be able to stand alone as poems. So the poem you asked me to read is actually word for word in American Copper also, which is kind of neat.
That's why I recognized it.
That's right. So The Violence Elegies. He rides bulls in every rodeo he can find. Every Saturday night, he fights in bars. Takes off his shirt to counter handholds. Doesn't drink. Tries not to when fighting. Seeks only the concave feel of facial structure. The slippery skin of cheekbones. The line of a man's jaw and the cool sockets of the eyes. He likes especially the sound these make as they give way. The sound of cartilage and how the skin slits open before the blood begins. The white hard glisten of bone, the sound of the face when it breaks. And he hears as if from the quiet eye of a child's dream, his mother saying, come home.
Since I've never hit anyone in the face, I did ponder that. The scene
I'm so
in
glad
the book.
To hear you haven't punched somebody in the face, Sheree.
Well, I don't want to hurt my hand. You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Sheree Newman talking with Shan Ray about his novel American Copper. This program is available as a podcast and at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link to it on our Facebook and Twitter pages. After a short break, we'll be back to talk more about the book. Shan Ray will also share his thoughts about ways in which non-Native people can repair damage from the past. Stay with us. Although most of the story takes place in the early part of the 20th century, you mentioned that the 1864 Sand Creek Massacre is also part of the story because it's the backstory for the Northern Cheyenne. If people aren't familiar, you know, a peaceful village, almost all of the people were slaughtered, most of them women and children, by a, I think it was a Colorado Territory militia.
Yeah, it was a militia, but it was set up under the U.S. Cavalry, and the leader was a Colonel Chivington, who was also called the Fighting Parson because he was a deacon in his Methodist church, I believe.
And I don't know how many years before that there was a Cheyenne chief who had a proposition for melding his people in with the white people.
Yeah, his vision. So when I think about that chief, you know, saying, give us 1,000 of your white women so that we can be together, you know, so that we can unify as cultures, it was a great vision. It wasn't something that the overly linear, super rational culture could receive at that time.
I mean, they didn't even ask for 1,000 women volunteers.
Yeah.
They might have gotten them.
I know, they might have. That's right.
They just
could have been a Shackleton-type call, you know.
Yeah.
Want women in the West, Cheyenne culture. You know, every culture, so my Czech culture and my German culture are two different cultures, and the Northern Cheyenne is a different culture than the Crow culture and the Blackfeet culture. And the Cheyenne were called the beautiful people, and all of us that have been lucky enough to be embraced and have, you know, our friendships in the Cheyenne culture know what that meant when they say the beautiful people. And, you know, it's side story to that is when my mom was on the reservation, one of my friends, again, Cleveland Bement, his mother was wearing this beautiful turquoise jewelry, the silver settings and turquoise. And my mom said, oh, that's so gorgeous. And at Christmas, Cecilia Bement, my friend's mom, arrived at our doorstep and presented the jewelry to my mom. Still touches me. And my mom said, I can't take that. And my mom actually started crying. And Cecilia said, this is what we do in our culture, you know. If somebody loves what you have, you give it to them freely because you love them. So that, I think that visionary circular component is really necessary in American society, which often gets over-focused on the individualized, linear, rational, and sometimes rejects the circular, mystical, and needs it for its own healing, even while it rejects it.
In the aftermath of the Sand Creek Massacre, Cheyenne Suicide Warriors fought at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. And about that, you wrote, quote, "This they did in the traditional way. The lowest and weakest among them gave their lives, the poorest ones with no guns, only bow and arrow, club and hatchet." And history is full of suicide warriors, kamikaze pilots, mm-hmm. suicide bombers. And it made me think about your profession. Aside from writing, you teach leadership and forgiveness studies at Gonzaga University. And I wondered, what do you say to students about the continuation of the lowest and the weakest among us continuing to kill themselves? Mm. How do you talk about that?
Well, in this one, it's fascinating. I think of it as a reversal. So those lowest immediately ascended to the highest in the Cheyenne culture. And that reversal is a form of balancing out dominant or elite culture and putting it actually below the most humble, you know. And it's a form of humbling our cultures. So that one, as I look at it in the Cheyenne culture, I see it differently than like the Cheyenne culture sort of forcing them into it. And I'm not totally sure how to think about it all over the world, you know, because there's so many different types of culture within culture. So if we look at the way Hitler, you know, Hitler's generals on the Russian front said, you know, we're going to lose all 250,000 of our people if we don't back out right now. And he said, die for your country.
Mm-hmm. And the kamikaze pilots, I think, were guaranteed a place in heaven for whatever they did. And the suicide bombers of today are...
Right. And I see those as expressions that are very different than the Cheyenne expression right there. I see those as expressions that were coming out of a culture of direct evil, basically, the ones that we're mentioning right there. Mm-hmm. So, and there are other cultures that are different than that. Like, so for example, the woman who decides that she needs to give her life for the benefit of her children in a given circumstance is totally different than someone that's given their life for a totalitarian and even evil regime, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think of it as a spectrum of ways of giving one's life, I guess. And some are appropriate and some are meaningful and some, you know, help us as people, and others are more like an extension or a projection of the ego of the leaders.
Well, many of us who are not American Indians feel overwhelmed by what happened to Native people and their cultures in the 19th and 20th centuries. Did writing this book help you sort out any of your own feelings with that?
You know, being a forgiveness researcher for the last 20 years, I think what has struck me is that all of us, if we do some research into our families and into our cultures, are born of atrocity. And the current unspoken atrocity in America is our lack of atonement and reparations for slavery and for genocidal harm against Native Americans, African Americans, people of non-dominant culture throughout America. And my own history is, like I mentioned, Czech and German, and the Germans performed ungodly atrocities on the Czechs during World War II to the level of taking large amounts of children and exterminating them and taking entire towns and wiping them from the face of the earth and covering those towns with landfill after killing everybody in it so that the town would not exist anymore. Basically, vengeance acts that Hitler was perpetrating against the Czechs. And having studied and looked at that and then recognizing that my German grandfather married my Czech grandmother, German-American and Czech-American grandmother, in New York City when Germany had invaded Czechoslovakia in World War II, you know, you can see how this all these things started to dovetail and come together. And so that research over the years pointed me to places like Asia and the Philippines and People Power One and People Power Two and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa and the work on restoration and forgiveness in Ireland and the restoration reparations process post-World War II between the German government and the Israeli government. and just gave me a great amount of sorrow that we haven't actually built that in America yet. And I believe it needs to be built now and has to, you know, involve all concerned parties and come out as meaningful to the parties that receive the atrocities, and that forgiveness, asking, atonement needs to happen. So the book is a part of that, not as a political statement, but as a form of art that calls us into those dialogues.
So on an individual basis, what do you recommend?
You know, I think for me, it's hard to know, you know, because we're all part of a larger structure, what bell hooks, the beautiful feminist writer, would call white supremacist patriarchal society, racist society. All of us are embedded in it. Everybody of every race is embedded in that. And that can sound like there's no hope, but she is one of the most loving and love-based writers. And she basically points the way to, you know, admitting that, all of us beginning to admit that that's what we're embedded in and that we are a part of it, and that, to, you know, the movements together toward being anchored in legitimate capital L-oriented love versus a small L, so something that's sacred or something that's divine, something that unites us, can call us into a real atonement with one another. And, you know, for me, it's just pursuing that individually and as a family with my own family, and, you know, being able to ask forgiveness, being able to admit one's faults, being able to make atonement on an individual level with others, and then extending that out nationally and internationally. And if a person has a desire to understand other cultures, I think we can see now that it's not about a white person going and becoming pseudo-Indian, and that appropriation is something that's kind of another echo of the pain, but it's about a supposed white, or there's all kinds of questions about whether there is even a white, that, you know, but dominant culture. It's about that level of culture becoming more humble, more vulnerable, and learning and listening, and there are great opportunities for that. So if you think of the Nez Perce Reconciliation Ceremony at the site of the Big Hole Massacre in northwest Montana, where Nez Perce leaders invite the descendants of the military that did the massacring to sit with the descendants of those who were massacred in a reconciliation and forgiveness ceremony. People can go and witness that. You know, people can begin to learn and listen. Sand Creek Massacre site has a yearly ceremony based on the run that the victims were forced into from the massacre site. And again, they welcome the whole culture to join them in that ceremony. So those things exist, and they are part of that expression from our own individual lives out to other people.
Shan Ray lives in Spokane, Washington. Look for more information about him at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Also there, you'll find poems and children's book reviews, as well as links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thank you for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridas. The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.